Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the 49ers Insider Podcast on NBCSportsBayArea.com. Introducing your host, San Francisco 49ers Insider, Matt Mayoko.
All right, I'm back with Mindy Bach on the 49ers Insider Podcast. And coming up a little bit later, my talk with George Seifert. So checking in with George Seifert.
That's great. Just so much history, and so many of these current defenses are predicated on what he did when he was with the 49ers as defensive coordinator and head coach. And we're seeing that even today under Kyle Shanahan's regime.
Yeah. So we'll talk to George, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but kind of give you an idea of what George is doing with his life. It's basically what everybody thought he'd be doing with his life after football. We set up something, and it's for Tuesday, the 49ers day off, and the phone rings at 8 a.m., and it's George. And he goes, "Hey, Matt, I'm going out to the water. I'm going to be on the water all day. Can we do this tomorrow?" And I was like, "Of course, George. We can do it anytime you want." So George Seifert, the guru of the defenses, and I think this defense that the 49ers have brought in with Robert Saleh out of the Pete Carroll tree is kind of a throwback, almost an homage to the 49ers that were so well coached on defense, also had a lot of talent, but so well coached on defense under George Seifert.
Yeah, and speaking to several of the players, they really like it. What they like about this defense is that it's keep it simple. They said there's really not a lot for them to know as far as play calls. Ahmad Brooks estimated they only have 10 different defensive play calls. He said that makes it really easy to communicate and know your job and know where your help is coming from. And then, of course, we're seeing the youth come in on that defensive front, that defensive line, and Eric Armstead, DeForest Buckner, and play those positions, especially Eric Armstead, that George Seifert started so many years ago.
Yeah. In fact, I talked to Robert Saleh. You know, the 49ers, they used to be called the elephant position. Now it's called the Leo position. And Eric Armstead, who is not that prototypical elephant / Leo player, he's so big. But I asked Robert Saleh about the origins of the Leo and also how Eric Armstead fits in this 49er defense. And here's Robert Saleh, the 49ers defensive coordinator. So, Robert, first off, you guys have introduced the Leo position, which is similar, I believe, to the old elephant position here that George Seifert had with the 49ers. Do you know the origin of the Leo and why it's called Leo?
You know, I couldn't tell you the origin. My guess is that Pete, Coach Carroll, brought it in from USC. So when we were there in Seattle, it was introduced to us.
And when we talked to you about the Leo position in the offseason, you referenced certain players around the league, Von Miller being one. In the 49ers past, Charles Haley, and even before him, Fred Dean played that spot. Well, now you have Eric Armstead lining up there, and he's so much different body-wise than those guys. What is it about him and at that size that you think that he can handle what's needed from that position?
You know, he doesn't fit the prototype, like you said. Ideally, you want a blazer off the edge, but you're never going to turn down a good pass rusher. He's got great bendability. He's got a good set of pass rush moves. And so when you do have a really good pass rusher, you never want to turn your face to it just because he doesn't fit a mold. You know, they all come in different shapes and sizes. So with him, there's a lot of excitement just because of his ability to rush a passer.
Have you had to change the position at all because of him, or has he more changed his style because of the defense?
He's more changed his style. He's done an unbelievable job getting into the shape he's been in, losing weight, and he looks really good.
And it's been nice to see Armstead because he came into this training camp much lighter, 15 pounds lighter. He's noticeably thinner. And I would say he's really stood out as far as his pass rushing abilities and how they've improved. I mean, in one practice, we saw him push an offensive lineman into the quarterback. So he got a sack that way. He really has.
Reminds me, that was Justin Smith, remember, against Jermon Bushrod?
Exactly. I completely see that in my mind right now. But Eric Armstead is definitely, he's noticeable this training camp. You can't miss his contributions on the field.
So I want to ask you this question. You've seen the 49ers practice. You were in Hawaii for a couple days there of the 49ers when they first opened training camp. But you've seen Kyle Shanahan. You've seen him run a practice. You've seen the offense, the defense. What's your initial reaction of, you know, how things look different than the past in this Kyle Shanahan regime?
I've seen two padded practices, and the one thing that Chip Kelly did as well, the pace is there, but it seems like there is more involvement, if that makes sense. The intensity is there by the players, and you can see the intensity in the players. They're playing all the way to the whistle, past the whistle, but it's because there are so many players involved. We see the offensive line. There's so many different players on the offensive line, and other than really Joe Staley at that left tackle, and then Trent Brown is pretty much entrenched at right tackle. All the three positions in between have been rotated, and they've been between the ones and the twos and the threes, or the one and the two and the three quarterback, and the same with all the positions. And it's been seamless the way they do it.
The thing that has stood out to me is how aggressive they are offensively. I mean, we in the past, and this isn't a knock on the quarterbacks or maybe it's a knock on the mentality, but it just seemed like we would go practice after practice after practice and never see a deep pass. It was always check down. But with Brian Hoyer and Kyle Shanahan, you know, after a few running plays, you go, oh, I think he's setting up the defense for the deep shot. And sure enough, Brian Hoyer has looked pretty good getting the ball down the field. And Marquise Goodwin has looked very good as a potential deep threat for this 49ers offense.
Yeah, it's not just Hoyer, though, too. You're right. It's all the quarterbacks. I mean, Beathard and Barkley as well. I've been impressed. I was impressed my very first day with Pierre Garçon and the connection that he has with Hoyer in those mid-range routes as well, and a couple of deep routes. So you're right. I agree with you there. There are more deep shots than I have seen in a while.
So what else? You talked to Kyle Juszczyk. What do you think about Kyle Juszczyk and how he can help this Kyle Shanahan offense?
It's been really interesting. I saw him line up in the I formation twice today in consecutive plays, and twice he did two different things. Or each time he did two different things. Once he went out and blocked Aaron Lynch, and then the next time he went out, cut right, then cut left, and then they threw the ball to him. He was wide open in the flat. So I've just seen his versatility through two practices. I think it's very apropos he's wearing number 44 because he's wearing it for his favorite player, who was Dallas Clark, the tight end for the Colts. But then 49er fans know 44 as Tom Rathman, the fullback, and that's exactly what he's been doing this training camp. He's training with the tight ends as well as being the fullback role. So he is very multifaceted, and he's given the defense something to think about for sure.
I'll be talking to George Seifert coming up here on the 49ers Insider Podcast. Do you have any Seifert memories? Or, I mean, what when you think of George Seifert and what he was able to accomplish with the 49ers, what kind of comes to your mind?
The one thing that just stands out to me about George Seifert, he was a little bit before my time, but...
Gee, thanks, because I covered him.
I know, you covered him. He was so stoic on the sideline. I have this image of him in my head, of just how his team was performing at such a high level and a fast level, yet he was always just kind of the rock on the sideline. Yeah. That's how I remember George Seifert.
I agree with that. So, Mindy, you and I are doing a bunch of these Facebook live chats. We'll be down here all training camp. And are you enjoying the Facebook Live and kind of the new stuff that we're doing on NBC Sports? BayArea.com.
It's fun. I like hearing the questions that people have. Some of them are the same questions, so I have to keep in mind, okay, maybe they didn't tune in on Monday and listen. But yeah, it's fun. It's fun to interact with the fans and hear what's important to them or what they're paying attention to and the players that they want to watch, because there's so many players that, and people are watching so many different players. So it keeps us on our toes too to make sure that we're on top of that. But I do. I enjoy it. It's fun.
All right. It's Mindy Bach. And now we'll go to George Seifert here on the 49ers Insider Podcast. Well, George, thank you so much for joining me on the 49ers Insider Podcast. I guess the first question, what have you been up to since your retirement? I know you're a big outdoorsman. I would assume you've been on a lot of streams, rivers, lake.
You know, actually, I have. It's been, I guess, close to 14 years, something like that. But at any rate, I have done quite a bit of hunting, you know, from the Northwest Territories and the Yukon to South America, Argentina and Chile and so forth, and fished in a lot of those different spots as well. You know, I have a place, I live in Nevada, I have a place in Bodega Bay. So this time of year, I usually come down here and fish for salmon, spend quite a bit of time on the ocean.
One of the things that, when I started covering you, the thing that I quickly realized was it seems like so many football coaches, they're all about football. But you seem to have a very well-rounded life and interests outside of football. Was that important for you while you're coaching to kind of keep in touch with the outside world?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I feel fortunate from the standpoint that that I did enjoy, you know, hiking and backpacking and all those things developed, you know, when I was a young man, you know, growing up, going out with fishing or camping or whatever with your dad or rest of the family. And so those were all happy times, and it, you know, can be an escape and a time to charge your battery. So, you know, the couple of weeks that we might get off during the off season, you know, that was usually something we'd do together as a family. And now I'm able to enjoy that same type of time with my grandchildren.
Do you have a go-to spot someplace where, you know, as you look out a couple months, you know, you know you're going to be in this one spot at a particular time?
You know, there are probably a couple. One of them certainly has been Sonoma Coast from the time I was a kid. And then up in the Trinity County, Trinity Alps area, was at one point I lived up in that area. And so
you lived in Hoopaw, right?
Pardon me? Why I went to Hoopaw, yeah. And so I would naturally, you know, want to go back there. And so that was always a stop that the family would take. And when we had free time, we'd go there up somewhere along the Sonoma Coast.
Yeah, so, I mean, your story is one of the more fascinating stories. Obviously, a San Francisco native, Polytechnic High School. You were a 49er fan from a long time ago. What's your earliest memory of the San Francisco 49ers?
Well, you know, my high school was right across the street from the stadium, and we played all our high school games in Keysar. We practiced in Golden Gate Park right next to Keysar. So Sunday, when the 49ers were there, our head football coach, Mel Dax, would, you know, get us a job. Basically, he would say, here's your job, you're going to be an usher. Well, it was really a way to get into the game and watch the game for free. And so I grew up enjoying, you know, Y.A. Tittle and Joe Perry and Hugh McElhaney and Billy Wilson, R.C. Owens and Bob St. Clair and so many other, you know, greats during that particular period. And, you know, obviously that's when I became a 49er fan. And, you know, just, how lucky can you be then eventually to wind up coaching the team that you rooted for all the time when you were a young kid?
Yeah, I mean, you joined Bill Walsh's staff, I believe, in Bill's second year with the 49ers. When you had that opportunity, I mean, did that almost seem, and you're a defensive backs coach, did it almost seem at that point that that was as good as life could get?
It did. You know, I even enjoyed the fact when I first went to coach at Stanford, the first person I worked for there at Stanford was Jack Christensen, who had been a great player himself, but he was also the head coach at one time of the 49ers. So I thought it was neat just rubbing elbows with him. And then when I worked for Bill as an assistant, actually I was on my way when he hired me to the 49ers, I was leaving Stanford to go work at Green Bay Packers. And Bill said, wait a day or two, I got to work something out here. And so, yeah, it was a lifelong dream, certainly, to wind up, you know, working there as an assistant or usher or whatever job they had for me.
How did you and Bill first get to know each other?
Really, I had been a coach at Stanford. I like I said, with Jack Christensen, I left. Bill became the head coach. You know, the people, I knew quite a few people there. They introduced my name to Bill. He interviewed me and hired me. And I remember we were at Ricky's. He said, come on over and meet me at Ricky's down in Palo Alto at that time. And he said, well, you know, I'm going to hire you. I don't know what position you're going to coach, but I want you to be one of my coaches. So that was our first, that was Bill's first year with Stanford.
Were you upstairs in the NFC Championship game?
Oh, yes. Yeah. When Dwight caught the pass?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And it was one of the thrilling moments of my life, because I remember the Deep Depression in 1957 at Kezar when we lost to Detroit. Otherwise, we'd have been playing for a championship, and the gloom over the city, and then the joy and the thrill of winning the game against Dallas and realizing that we're going on to the Super Bowl, and, you know, driving over to my mother-in-law's house in Geneva and Mission and people on top of cars and climbing telephone poles and the like, and the whole city was a party.
Yeah. Well, before that party, though, and after Dwight's catch, you're the defensive backs coach, and you saw a play with a bird's eye view develop that very well could have been the end of your career.
Yeah, you had absolutely. So yes, you know, and I every time I am around Eric Wright, I thank him, and I tell my grandkids whenever they're around him to thank him for what we have. It's because of his tackle, Dan White had thrown a pass to Drew Pearson, and he was going to split our secondary. This is after the catch, and Drew Pearson was going to score the winning touchdown after the catch. And somehow Eric Wright caught up to him and dove out and grabbed him by the back of the shoulder pads and threw him to the ground, which now would be an illegal play.
Do you ever, boy, do you ever wake up in a cold sweat at night, even all these years later, thinking about what would have happened had Drew Pearson wiggled free?
Well, I really don't have to think about it very much. I think I know what would have happened between Eddie and Bill. I mean, that would have been an easy decision. So, no, we like I said, we thank Eric Wright, like I said, each time I visit with him.
Well, you know, I've heard so many people, George, through the years talk about, you know, how Bill Walsh, clearly an innovator on an offense. But a lot of people I talk to also believe that you were just every much the defensive guru as Bill was on offense. And, I mean, you became the defensive coordinator a couple years after the first Super Bowl. Where were your defensive principles kind of rooted? Like, what was your belief, you know, in putting together a defense, and what did you want your defenses to become?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be very simplistic. You know, great players, and that's what we had. I mean, if you look through the roster of defensive players that we had, not only experience but talent, and it was interesting. I was talking with a player here actually today, one of the former players, and during that period earlier today, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, and I know I'm getting off topic a little bit, but I think this is important because how these players all came into our team at that particular time, and we all pat ourselves on the back for what great scouting or scouts we were, and you know, acquiring that talent through the draft and free agency, and yet the thing, the amazing thing about it was that these fellows were all natural, you know, competitors. It's amazing to me that so many great competitors came together at the same time, and that you can't always scout and draft. You think you are, but it's a unique situation, and so many of them came together at that particular time. As far as the, you know, my defense, you know, you wanted to change up as much as you could. You didn't want the opposing team to get a real handle of what you were doing, so you tried to come up with quite a few variations, and that sounds fine, but the trick of it was trying to, at the same time, make it simplistic in what we did with our design so the players didn't have to think a lot. You know, initially it might be trying, but eventually it would all fall into place where they could turn themselves loose as players. We had variation, but it was presented in such a way, I think it was fairly simplistic.
So when you become the head coach then of the 49ers, how involved were you on the defensive side? I mean, I'm assuming it was still your defense. Were you more of a delegator at that point, or did you still take a really vested interest in the down-to-down, the snap-to-snap intricacies of what was going on the other side of the ball?
Yeah, well, I've always been accused of being too much hands-on, whether it be offense, defense, or special teams. You know, I you know, if there's one thing that I might irritate some of the coaches with, maybe I was a little too hands-on looking back, but I felt I was a head coach, so I had to do that. As far as the defense, though, you know, we had there are two kind of unsung heroes with regard to our staff during that period, and one on the offensive side was Bob McKittrick, the offensive line coach, and on the defensive side was Bill McPherson. And, you know, Bill and I had worked together for so many years, and I leaned on him so much, so it was a natural. Then he was the defensive coordinator where I became the head coach. And I probably was, you know, a little more involved maybe than I'm not going to say I should have been. I did what I thought was right at the time. Then eventually Bill became the you might say, assistant head coach of defense, and Ray Rhodes became our defensive coordinator. And so I probably, you know, got made too involved in some of the meetings at times, until one time Ray came in and said, hey, am I the defensive coordinator or not? And I said, yes, you are. And so basically he was asking me to let him be the coordinator. And I backed off, and he was a great coordinator, as Mac was, and certainly then Pete Carroll after that. And then we also, you know, Jeff Fisher was on that staff. So we had a pretty talented group of people to work with.
So when Pete Carroll comes in, that was after the Super Bowl, and he had already been a head coach, and I think he was just let go by the Jets, and you hired him. Did he pick up your system? Did he continue to implement the system that he had run in the past, or how did that work?
No, he basically picked up our system. As each of the offensive coaches, you know, from when Mike Holmgren left, you know, well, when Bill left, Mike was our offensive coordinator, and when I was the head coach, and you know, we continued with, that was the prerequisite of being the coordinator, was that we continued with the offensive system. And then when Mike left, Mike Shanahan came in. Well, when Pete Carroll came in, he basically adopted our system, though Pete had a unique way of injecting his own philosophies, and to a point to where we could see that things that he was doing certainly fit in with our system, but it even took it a step further. And the way he coached defensive backs and his innovative, you know, blitz zones where you play a zone coverage, but yet you're blitzing extra people. And so, you know, he got to a point where he was pretty much running his own ship, and I had pretty much backed off.
And so when Pete, you know, as you followed Pete's career, and I don't know how closely you watched the Seahawks, but certainly their, you know, their defense has been one of the tops in the league now for quite some time. Do you still see the thumbprints of the 49ers from the mid-90s and what you were running back then and what the Seahawks do now?
You know, I can't say that I really studied them enough to be a, you know, give you an educated answer. I mean, certainly the aggressiveness and the way the defense of the secondary plays, you know, I certainly see Pete Carroll that was at San Francisco, now the Pete Carroll at Seattle now, that all coming to fruition. I think the thing also that Pete's done, he's kind of taken it a step further from what many coaches have done. It's in the way that he actually coaches the players and individualizes what they do to help get the best out of each one of them. He has a real knack for that.
One of the defining characteristics of your defense was that elephant position. I believe it was Fred Dean the first one, or obviously Charles Haley. But can you kind of describe what the elephant position is?
Yeah, well, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting in that the first time we ever used an elephant, I was coaching at Stanford with Bill and a fellow named Brian Holloway, who was actually and he was a highly recruited athlete and was an offensive lineman, eventually played from Stanford, went on to play in the NFL as an offensive lineman. But he was a big, talented athlete, and we needed a pass rusher just to spot pass rush. And so we created a way, a fourth lineman, and we would move him around different positions and rush him at a place to our advantage. And then when we got to the 49ers, we started doing the same thing. And like you say, with Fred Dean, even to a point where we dropped him into coverage, as well as have him, he's one of the great, so we didn't do that too often because he's one of the great pass rushers ever. You don't want to drop him into coverage too often. But we did move him around. Sometimes We'd line him up as a middle linebacker just so we could blitz him from a different position. And then, you know, we went on from there to where Charles Haley came. That kind of became the anchor point of the defense. He was a great pass rusher. We put him in, again, advantageous places. And then our coverage would revolve basically wherever he was, it would revolve towards him. And he would flip-flop and move in different positions.
I was just talking to Robert Saleh, who's the 49ers defensive coordinator now and comes from the Pete Carroll tree. And the 49ers use what they call the Leo position. And I asked him, you know, how did the name Leo come about? He didn't know, but he said it was something that Pete Carroll brought to Seattle. Do you remember how the name Elephant came about?
You know, I honestly, like I said, it first came about when we were coaching at Stanford.
Yeah, but the name is, you know,
that's the term that we used at that time. Okay. You know, and I don't remember who came up with it. It was another defensive coach. If it was me or if it was Bill Walsh, I honestly don't remember that. Mm-hmm.
I was just talking to one of your former players, Dennis Brown, who happened to walk by, and I told him I was going to be talking to you, and
he said, Dennis.
Yeah, and Dennis said, man, he was rough on me, you know, with the weight stuff, but the one thing about George, he was always fair. And so he told me to tell you hi.
That was a nice thing to say. Thank you.
And I guess that's, as a coach, that's all you wanted to be, right? Just, you wanted to be known. You could be tough and everything, but you wanted to be fair.
Well, yeah, certainly you do. But, you know, at the same, it's kind of interesting. In the years that I coached, the thing that was kind of funny for me to realize is that, you know, the players really didn't have to like you. And this will kind of sound different, but they didn't even have to respect you. What they had to do is realize that you were going to help them, that you were so good at understanding what you were teaching them, that you were going to help them become better. And if they sense that you could help them become a better player, whether you're the coordinator or the position coach or the head coach, they'd pretty much go through the wall for you. And the other things were fine, but they weren't the main factor. The main factor was, did they sense that you could make them a better player?
Were there any players that come to mind that you kind of felt like were tougher sells than others as far as that goes?
Oh, absolutely. But I, you know, I just soon not get into the individuals that way.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to ask you about one guy in particular. And this was obviously toward the end or at the end of your coaching career with the 49ers, but Terrell Owens. You know, you had him before he became, you know, the nationally
Terrell
known.
We had him before he became T.O. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
And he, you know, I remember, I think it was the Vinny Serrato was a scout at the time, and him bringing him to the forefront during the draft, and you know, certainly a big, strong receiver. And I forget exactly where we drafted him or when, but he came into camp and he worked hard and he was quiet, and he was not a real consistent receiver at the time, but you know, over then the next few years with the other players being around, and he became this wonderful, talented player, but during the period of time that he was playing for when I was coaching, it was a different personality.
As you watched his career develop, you know, his name comes up every January, February with the Hall of Fame. What do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think he should?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that as you know, his athletic abilities and his performance on the field as a player and what he accomplished and his receiving ability and overall strength. I mean, yeah, he's one of the great receivers, you know, ever to play the game. And, you know, it's like Deion Sanders. You know, I think the best cornerback I ever coached was Eric Wright, but the best cover corner I ever coached was Deion Sanders. But he had this other theatrical part of his life as well and playing. But as a player on the field game day, you know, Deion was phenomenal, and I think certainly Terrell Owens was an outstanding player.
Yeah, yeah. Mike Shanahan was on your staff for that final Super Bowl, and kind of interesting how the 49ers, you know, have now hired Kyle Shanahan, Mike Shanahan's son. Kyle was around in those days, right? Did you know him very well when he was a youngster?
You know, I really didn't know him well. I kind of vaguely remember him at camp, But I, you know, it's like, you know, that time of your life and what you're trying to accomplish and do. I mean, my mind, I was kind of, you know, had blinders on anyway. I was always looking straight ahead. And so I missed out on a lot of those peripheral things around me other than just the football and trying to win the next game. But I'm certainly excited and happy for him. And it looks like it's a neat hire and to look at his background and what he was able to accomplish. And then certainly, his father, I'm sure, has had great influence on him. And Mike was an outstanding coach for us and one of the great coaches.
Yeah, you were inducted into the Edward J. DeBarlo Sr. 49ers Hall of Fame in 2014. So you are immortalized here at Levi's Stadium. And you feel good about, now that you're retired and fishing and hunting, about the direction of the organization with Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch and what you know about those two men?
Yeah, I don't know either one particularly well, but I certainly know of their backgrounds and you couldn't get more impressive. And then, with Jed, they're all kind of the three of them are kind of the same age, I believe, or similar in age. And am I right or wrong?
Yeah,
on
no,
that?
That's right. Yeah.
So they're kind of the three of them are tied at the hip and the three of them, it's a sink or swim, man. We got to go out and win the ball game. So I'm sure it's a kind of a fun thing for the three of them to get together and kibitz about what they have to get done. But there's a lot of brain power there and a lot of experience. And I mean, I'm excited to watch them, get the team back on track. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I from a personal standpoint, I started covering the team in the early 90s. And I'd been covering high school sports, and when I step in and I'm covering, a Super Bowl champion and a Super Bowl champion head coach like you, George, one of the things that I was just kind of struck by was just how down to earth you were and continue to be, and how it just seemed like, I could cover high school coaches who had bigger egos than you did. So thank you for making my transition from covering high school sports and college sports to then covering one of the elite franchises in all of football.
Yeah, it was certainly a lot of fun. You ask about my thoughts about the past and so forth, and the thing that's it's hard to live with sometimes, but you don't remember any of the wins. The only ones you remember, and there's some gut-wrenching losses, that you just can't shake them, no matter how big fish you're catching, how many big fish, or how many hikes or your hunting trips, how successful they might be. Those losses, boy, they tear you apart. In fact, I still remember losing the high school championship game in Kezar Stadium in 1957. So, you want to know how it is for an old football coach. That's one of the things that is kind of part of the history.
Yeah. Well, you did a lot more winning than losing.
Career,
the 49ers top winning percentage from a head coach, 766, two Super Bowls. And I believe when you took over as head coach, what did your wife, what kind of advice did she give you?
Yeah, don't screw it up. Yeah. Yeah, everybody remembers that one. Most wives, I assume they've told their husband that once or twice throughout their marriage.
Well, yeah, you didn't screw it up, George. So, and thanks. A job well done as 49ers head coach, and your post football career. You're doing exactly what I think everybody thought you'd be doing, and I'm very happy for you and your family.
Thank you,
and thank you very much for joining me on the 49ers Insider Podcast.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Matt. You have a great day.
The 49ers Insider Podcast on NBCSportsBayArea.com.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.